listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered community radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in sunny Fairfield, Iowa.
Sunny it is.
And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. If you're listening on Monday, it's good morning. I hope it's sunshine and then too.
And Writers' Voices is broadcast usually live at 1 p.m. on Fridays and rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. Also available live stream at KRUUFM.com. And I am finally actually getting caught up with getting the shows up on our website at writersvoices.com. So I'm posting a couple of past shows every week. So if you missed one and want to check it out there, it's writersvoices.com.
Good. Well, not that you don't have something else to do, but I don't know how you do everything.
So, Mom, tell us who we have with us today.
Well, today we have a young woman called by the name of Clara Benson. And Clara, this is quite an interesting book, an adventure. It's an adventure. The name of the book is No Baggage, and she goes on a world tour with
no baggage. No baggage, a minimalist tale of love and wandering.
Now, she is a writer, and she lives in Austin, Texas. And No Baggage is her first book. And for more information, you can visit her at clarabenson.com or on Twitter at Clara Benson.
And that's Benson. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Clara.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Now, this book came about in a bit of an unusual way. Would you like to tell us the story behind the story?
Sure. So I took this adventure, as you were saying. Back in 2013, I met this guy online, Jeff Wilson, on OkCupid. We hit it off right away, and within just a few weeks of knowing each other, he invited me to come on this summer travel experiment he'd been planning from Istanbul to London, 21 days and no plans, no itineraries. He's a very spontaneous person, and he wanted to just show up and see what would happen. And so he... We really hit it off, and so he invited me to join him on this trip within a couple dates, and I had this feeling that I should go, and so I said yes. And a week before we left, he called me and said the experiment still wasn't challenging enough, two strangers taking off together and no plans whatsoever, and he said, you know, what we should do is just get on the plane with what we're wearing and see what happens if we do that. And we wear the same clothes 21 days straight. We'll kind of test ourselves to see what you really need when you're on the road. And so I said, no way, I'm not doing that. Then I changed my mind for reasons that I go into in the book. And I ended up in the airport in Houston, just standing there in a green dress with a little side purse that had my passport, toothbrush, deodorant, change of underwear, and then Jeff beside me who just had a few things in his pockets. And then that's where the adventure started.
Now, had Jeff done something like this before?
He had. He'd been slowly working his way up over the last few years. He'd been taking these trips where he couch surfed for all kinds of places around the world, and each trip he would leave a little bit more behind. but this was his first time doing, nothing.
Wow. I can't even imagine saying yes to that.
I can't either.
What about you?
Oh, my parents couldn't either.
Yeah, what about you and where you were in your life right then made this even something you would even consider?
You know, when I met Jeff and when I joined online dating OKCupid. I just emerged from a really challenging period of my life post-college. I graduated at the height of the economic crisis and for a variety of reasons didn't handle it very well. So I had just come out of a period of a pretty severe anxiety, wasn't able to hold down a job. But I had gotten to the point where I was stable again and ready to go back out into the world, and I figured, why not online dating?
Sure, why not?
Yeah, why not? I also had this, you know, my expectations for how my life was supposed to go had been pretty much eradicated by that point, so I was very open to all sorts of experiences. I didn't have a real prescribed idea of what I should do next. And so when Jeff showed up with this invitation, it was kind of like, why not? What do I have to lose at this point? So I said yes.
You know, I think it's harder to grow up these days than when I was your age. When my daughter started college, I had this joke about when she started college in 1999, anyone with a four-year degree was guaranteed a $40,000 a year job. And when she graduated 4 years later, anyone with a four-year degree was guaranteed maybe getting a job at Starbucks. You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
The whole job market just sort of collapsed during that time. And then it started to build back up again, and then it collapsed again. And it does seem like your generation is a lot of people, they don't actually even want jobs. Do you find that true?
Well, yeah, and I talk about this then because not only are we supposed to graduate from college and get out there and find our way, there's a lot of, you know, my generation has been taught to follow our dreams and to be all that we can be and go out there and, you know, make it happen. So I think there's pressure not just to provide for yourself, but to create this really meaningful life that you've been dreaming of since you were a kid. And that is a lot of pressure, especially when you're just out of college and, you know, the realities of the job market and economics and it can be kind of a disorienting thing for a lot of people.
Yes, I can definitely see that. And you're right, this idea of that everybody, that you're, you know, I'm of the parenting generation that raised our kids to all think they were special.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of tough to be special sometimes.
Yeah, and of course everyone is special, you know, in their own way. And I do believe in pursuing a meaningful life. That's really an important part of my life. I just think the realities of life, you know, you have to find a way to make those two work, you know?
Yeah. Now, at what point in this adventure did you decide you were going to write about it?
So that part of it is almost as interesting as the story itself. So Jeff and I, we took this trip together, had a wild time, all kinds of adventures, came home and back to Austin, and nothing. I didn't really think anything of it. We took the trip really as a personal challenge and to see if we liked each other, kind of a crazy date. It wasn't until 5 or 6 months later that we were sitting around and he said, you know, it's kind of a good story. You know, you should think about writing that up. And so I did. I wrote it up and I cold submitted it to an editor at salon.com for their personal essay section. And and they loved it. So
And the title of it was?
The title of it, well, my title was 8 Countries, 1 Dress. And the way I wrote it, you couldn't even tell that Jeff and I were in a relationship at all. It was just totally about the minimalist adventure. But they asked me a few questions. They said, well, are you dating? And I said, yeah, sure, we're dating. And then the editor changed the title to The Craziest OK Cupid Date Ever.
yeah.
Yes, it's total clickbait, but man, it worked. that article, to my infinite surprise, it went viral overnight. My life changed within 24 hours.
Wow. So how did that impact you?
Well, in a lot of ways, my life was so wild already with Jeff. I mean, after we got back from that trip, he decided that he was going to, he's an environmental science professor, so he decided his newest experiment, he really likes experiments, would be to live in a dumpster for a year as a test of minimalist space. So he got his college to sign on, and that was happening as my article went viral. So, you know, it was just, everything was so surreal since I met him that it almost just seemed like a continuation of of the wildness from the trip, even.
When you met, he was living in his office, right?
Yes. Jeff kind of has a hobby of pushing back on social norms. So, yeah, when I met him, he was living in his office and had plans to move into a dumpster. Yeah, so I mean, it's all kind of weird. It was just a bizarre time. It was also really exciting because I had people from all over the world emailing me with their own stories and questions, asking for advice from me, you know, an unemployed writer at that point. And that was really wonderful. I love that part of it.
Of course, there are people who live in situations that aren't much better than a dumpster.
Or worse.
It's true. Yeah. It's true. Yeah. And his experiment set out to explore some of that and to talk about sustainability, and it had a lot of different applications. The students at his college were really involved in helping change it from a used dumpster to a very, very small house.
Uh-huh.
And so is that experiment finished now?
That one is finished, yes.
And did you write about it?
I did. That one also, I think, I can't remember the title of that one, but it's also, there's a piece in Salon about dating a guy who lives in a dumpster. that's out there as well.
Oh, gosh.
Now, did you always want to be a writer?
You know, I did. I've been writing since I was small, and I it's always, you know, talk about dreams, that was one of them, and but that article I published in Salon was the first thing I had ever pitched or published, so I think my route to becoming a writer was unexpected and very surprising.
Now, you said it went viral, and that changed your life. Did people start calling you for interviews and things like that?
Yes, almost immediately. I started getting calls to go on television shows. They flew Jeff and I up to The View to appear on their show. Yeah, the audience was horrified by the story that we were telling, but it was fun. We did several television appearances, lots of radio, but I also started getting calls from agents, too, both literary and film. So that was the first moment when I had people saying, you know, this story could make a really great book. Are you interested?
And did it take you long to decide yes?
No. How many times in your life does someone show up and say this and you want to be a writer? You know,
yeah.
It didn't take me long to decide. Although I had a feeling that I was jumping off, you know, off into the deep end of, you know, writing a book. I Googled how to write a book. I probably shouldn't say that.
Well, you're being honest. Okay. That's good. That's good. But what I want to know is there's so many details in. Did you keep a journal? Or how could you remember all that stuff?
We did keep journals. Both of us did. Uh-huh. Jeff is a chronic documenter. He records our conversations often. He's constantly taking notes in this little notebook he carries around. And he also photographs everything. And I had a notebook, too. We had real small notebooks. And we both kept notes and, you know, talked about conversations we'd had, people we'd met. So I actually had a pretty good record to draw from.
You had to.
But you didn't, you weren't taking this trip thinking, okay, I'm going to write about this later?
Not at all.
Not at all. Now, have you done additional no baggage trips after this one finished?
We have. We have done 5 total. So I'm pretty good at it now. And yeah, we've gone all over the world.
Wow.
Oh boy.
And why, what is it, you know, when I think about it, I think, well, I can understand the appeal of having minimal stuff to cart around, because I have done the foreign travel with way too much stuff. In fact, one of my last foreign trips, I was so busy up until the moment that I was ready to go. And the busier that you are, the less time you have to pack, the more you end up taking.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I'm like, okay, I'm not doing that again. But, but you know, what's wrong with, you know, a small backpack, a couple of changes of clothes? What is it?
There's nothing wrong. absolutely not. And in fact, that was my original plan before Jeff came up with the great idea to go with nothing. And what I usually say is that for us, you know, we weren't setting out to take a traditional holiday or vacation or even an adventure. It was much more of a social experiment than a vacation. And the idea was that we were going to set out, you know, 2 people, don't know each other, and we were going to take ourselves outside of our normal environment, familiar, and drop ourselves into a space that we didn't know. You know, we don't know the language. We don't know where we're going to sleep at night. We're trying to stay with locals only. And then just see what happens. See if we can get lost and navigate while being lost. You know, there's an art to flowing in the moment when you don't know what's happening around you. And so we wanted to test that, and going with nothing was another dimension of that. You know, it's kind of upping the challenge a little bit. You know, not only do we not know where we're going to stay, we don't even know when we're going to have a chance to wash our clothes next. And so we wanted to challenge ourselves. I think that was the main reason we did it. Although Jeff really does enjoy traveling with nothing, I will say that.
Yeah. Well, it's a little easier for a man for obvious reasons.
It is. Yeah. It is.
And, you know, but I wondered, you still have the dress?
Yeah, did you ever wear it again?
I have the dress, and I will never wear it again. it's in my closet. It's a very specific slice of my life, 3 weeks, and that was my uniform, and I've got so many memories attached to it. There's just no way I could ever wear it again.
Yeah, yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Clara Benson, author of No Baggage, A Minimalist Tale of Love and Wandering. So where you started in Istanbul and made your way to London, where are some of the places that you went and some of the highlights of the trip?
Well, the way that we traveled, we would just wake up in the morning and then look at a map and say, well, this looks interesting. Let's go here next. So we started in Istanbul. And Istanbul is actually one of the only cities that we've ever been back to twice. It's a magnificent city. We really enjoyed Turkey as a country also. It's incredible. So we were in Istanbul, and then we went southwest along the coast to Izmir, which is considered the kind of like the Venice Beach of Turkey, I guess. That's how the locals described it to us, but kind of more of a bohemian culture. And what was really interesting is that we landed in Turkey the summer of 2013. The country was experiencing a lot of protests against the government in all of the cities, and in Istanbul especially, there were huge protests. And so our families were concerned that we were landing right in the middle of that. But it wasn't a problem. It was actually really interesting to be in the city. There was so much energy, and there were flags everywhere. In Izmir, we actually were caught up in a protest. We got separated in the middle of it. We couldn't find each other for quite a while. But we always felt safe. You know, you can get a sense of when a situation is okay to be around and when it's time to leave. And that was actually a really interesting part of the beginning of our journey. And then from Turkey, we went, we took an overnight ferry across to Greece in Athens. And Jeff woke me up early and made me hike up the mountain or the hill that the Parthenon sits on. We were the very first people there. And he ran up the mountain to see the Parthenon and the Acropolis at dawn. No other tourists. It was just us. Sunrise coming through the pillars. It was, you know, one of the most beautiful travel moments I've ever experienced before. And then we went to a couple other places in Greece, and then our plan was to go to Serbia, but the bus was full, so we got on another bus that ended up going to Budapest in Hungary, which was a 23-hour bus ride. And then we hitchhiked back down from there through Croatia and through Bosnia as well.
Wow.
So all kinds of adventures along the way. And then we finished out in Scotland and then in London.
Well, how did you get from Croatia and Bosnia to Scotland? That's quite a ways.
Yeah, we had a cheap flight from Dubrovnik, Croatia, up to Edinburgh. There's you know, all the cold UK folks like to get down to the Mediterranean, so they have cheap flights that go back and forth.
Ah, very good. And you said when you went, you didn't have any plans of where you were sleeping each night. How did you find a place to stay?
That was one of my biggest worries before we left, because I had never traveled like this before. And so, actually, our first night in Istanbul, when we landed, we didn't know where we were going to stay. We said that we wouldn't make accommodations with couch surfing, which is you stay with locals along the road. More than a day in advance. And so we landed, we had no idea where we were going to stay, and Jeff insisted, instead of finding an internet cafe and getting set up, that we would just wander around the city, and which I thought was a horrible idea. But we checked our email later, and he started laughing because this guy that he'd met in Kazakhstan, an Iranian bicyclist, years earlier, also happened to be in Istanbul there at the same time, and he was house-sitting for a friend and had an extra bedroom. And he just happened to email Jeff and say, "Hey, I see that you're here too. Do you need a place to stay?" And so that's how our first night unfolded. And many nights subsequently were, it's just kind of talking to people, meeting friends, and it just sort of worked out.
Wow. That's amazing. That really is amazing.
Yes.
And most people that you met spoke English?
Not always. It depended. The couch surfers that we stayed with, for the most part, yes. But then while we were on the road, you know, we hitchhiked with four or five different people, and most of them, there was no shared language, maybe a few words. So you just get by with, you know, hand signals and facial expressions. We had one woman that was telling us a bus route. She was gardening in her front yard, and she used her hoe to write out the numbers of the street that we wanted in the dirt. So it's, you know, you use what you have.
Wow. Well, Clara, why don't you read from No Baggage so that the listeners can get an idea of what this book's really like?
Sure. Okay. So I'm actually going to read a scene from that first day in Istanbul. As Jeff and I leave the airport, and instead of getting organized, we wander around. And at that point, I didn't know which continent I was on when we landed in Istanbul, because Istanbul is one of the only cities in the world that actually straddles two continents. So I'll start there. Jeff jerked a thumb out the train window. "Let's try this stop." We stumbled out into a broad Istanbul thoroughfare. The dusty street was a cacophonous symphony of taxi horns, sirens, and clanging trams. It looked central, but I had no idea. On either side of the street, six-story buildings were lined shoulder to shoulder. red flags, air conditioning units, satellite dishes, and mini shade awnings spilled out of windows that overlooked a crowded sidewalk lined with palms. I shaded my eyes and peered down the street in either direction. "So, now we wander?" I said. "Yep, now we wander," said Jeff. "Right or left?" Not that it mattered. Left, said Jeff, hooking down the boulevard, his Stetson bobbing through a swarm of pretzel vendors and sun visored tourists, almost like he actually knew where he was going. For him, movement was an art. Back in Austin, he once recounted how, in college, his father had paid for him to take a career aptitude test. After days of measuring analytical prowess, hand-eye coordination, and pattern recognition, the results declared him a promising candidate, not for business consultant or entrepreneur, but for riverboat captain. Somehow, it fit. I could easily imagine him guiding a steamboat down the Mississippi, intuitively maneuvering the fickle moods of the river with a soggy, unlit cigar clenched between his teeth, some kind of Mark Twain rascal. I was more than happy for Jeff to play the role of guide. The two of us had already established our roles in rambling walks across Austin. I processed the magic of the environment. He moved us through it. I was poet, he was steersman. It wasn't that I was totally incapable of navigation. I could get by if I focused hard. But the handing off the compass allowed me to orient to a completely different set of markers, like light. In Texas, where it's mostly broad and flat, the sun presses into your shoulders and the clouds congregate in cumulus mountains that cast shadows across the dirt for miles. But in Istanbul, the summer light is ethereal. It glitters gold in the afternoon, refracted into the air on all sides by the Black Sea, the Sea of Marmara, and the Bosphorus. As poet and steersman, we were following a long tradition of indiscriminate wandering. Taking the pulse of an urban landscape on foot was hardly a new idea. The French had their own word for urban ramblers, the flâneur. The 19th century flâneur was a modern exploratory stroller who took in the boulevards and arcades as a moving photograph of urban experience, as the French journalist Victor Fornell put it. The poet Charles Baudelaire also captured the process with lyrical flair. For the perfect flâneur, for the passionate spectator, it is an immense joy to set up house in the heart of the multitude, amid the ebb and flow of movement, in the midst of the fugitive and the infinite, to be away from home and yet to feel oneself everywhere at home, to see the world, to be at the center of the world, and yet to remain hidden from the world. To observe the streets of Istanbul through the eyes of an urban flâneur was to notice that I wasn't the only one unsure of which continent I was standing on. The city of Seven Hills had continuously shifted with the swell and decay of empires and was, even now, negotiating its identity within a complex juxtaposition of East and West, religious and secular, modern and traditional. On the sidewalk, Turkish women in fluorescent miniskirts and silver hoop earrings brushed past other women in full hijab. Political posters for pro-secular supporters hung on walls that echoed with the ezan calls to prayer, nearly the only Arabic one could hear in the city. Sleek modern facades with small cafes and boutique hotels were buttressed up against old stone walls that looked as if they'd been sitting since the days when the city went by Constantinople. Neither Jeff nor I spoke as we drifted in and out of noisy streets. It was a comfortable silence. We moved at whim, our route governed by intrigue. A man in a dark cap shaving a slice of lamb off a vertical kebab rotisserie. An aproned woman tending a display of mountains of Turkish delight cut into perfect sticky powdered squares. Or a sweaty bargaining trinket salesman. We were caught up in a sensory parade, a blur of dense throngs, street hawkers, flags, seagulls, and the afternoon ikindi call to prayer, when shadows cast by objects are equal to their heights. After a while, I signaled Jeff to cut off into a cobbled side alley, away from the din of the main street. It was immediately quiet except for a few shopkeepers sorting through shoeboxes and an ancient man sitting in the corner squeezing orange juice from a metal press. I traded a lira and a mangled Turkish thank you for a small cup. We sipped the juice on a shaded staircase nearby, warm and frothy sweet. I closed my eyes and sunk my head into Jeff's shoulder. It was late afternoon and we still had no place to stay. I still didn't know which continent I was on. Our flaneur Rome hadn't cured me of the desire for psychological handrails. I was still disturbed by the vast openness of the moment. So there was another part of me, a wild and curious part, that was beginning to wonder if there wasn't something sacred about intentionally wandering with nothing. It's a rare thing to be lost, isn't it? I said. I mean, you catch a news clip every once in a while about a hiker who disappears in the woods or a Cessna pilot who turns up in a snowdrift. But for the most part, you know exactly where you stand on the planet, down to a precise red dot on a Google map. Walking around without a GPS lady who tells you to turn right at the fork is sort of old-fashioned, right? Like, it's obsolete to be unaware of where you are in space. That's what's interesting, said Jeff, with his eyes closed. When you're lost, you can't go from point A to point B because you don't know your relation to either point in the first place. When there's no point A, point B ceases to exist. He was always reciting these little made-up proverbs. It was impossible to say whether they were nuggets of profound Yoda wisdom or complete nonsense delivered with a straight face. He probably didn't know the difference himself. Okay, I rolled my eyes. The idea of having no point B is alarming. Like, even though I know I'm not in any mortal danger, I feel alarmed because I can't predict where we're going to sleep tonight or when I'm going to be able to wash the grease out of my hair. We're just floating along, and I have to assume that I'll be able to handle whatever pops up out of the ether. Well, I popped out of the OkCupid ether, right? And maybe we don't need to handle anything. Just hop on the A train, kick back with the gin in the drink car, and watch what happens.
And that was Clara Benson reading from No Baggage, A Minimalist Tale of Love and Wandering. How much did you involve Jeff in your writing process when you started writing the book?
Well, I sat him down when I got the opportunity to tell this story, and I said, you know, look, I'm going to be writing about our travel experience, but it's not a good story unless I talk about our relationship, you know, and all of the complications of that, too. To make a real good story, there has to be tension. And he was fine with that. He was open to me writing whatever I wanted. You know, he's not afraid of almost anything, and so he was fine. But I will say, you know, we had only known each other maybe 7 or 8 months when I got the chance to write this book, and it's not the normal relationship structure, like meet someone, fall in love, and then write a memoir about your relationship. That's not how it goes, at least for me in the past. So that was interesting because we weren't sure, you know, if we would even be together when I finished the book. And in a way, the ending of the story was unknown. And so that's strange to me. And it was tough at times.
It was what?
It was difficult you know, if the ending would be us taking another trip together or me going off into sunset alone. I wasn't sure.
And are you sure not yet, or is it still in kind of a work in process?
Well, I think most relationships are, but we are still together. It's been 3 years, and we've settled down a little bit in terms of our commitment to be together. But you never know with us. It's, who knows what'll happen?
Well, you never know with anybody these days.
It's true.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the Constantinople Istanbul thing. I guess I don't know how that came about. Do you know how that came about, that it changed the name of the city?
Well, I mean, the history of Istanbul, it goes way, way, way back, and it's changed hands so many times. I think the name change from Constantinople to Istanbul, Constantinople was the name of the capital of the Byzantine Empire, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the Istanbul changed, and it was a more modern name. I can't remember exactly, with the Ottoman Empire. I don't know the historical date, but it's changed names many times over the last few centuries.
There's a song about that, you know. Istanbul, really? Not Constantinople. Yeah.
Yeah. I enjoyed reading about your visit to Greece. I also visited Athens and Delphi.
Oh, did you?
Yes, in 2010 with my daughter and a friend of hers from Bulgaria. And we stayed at the, you know, we were traveling in a much different way. So we stayed at a hotel that was called the Acropolis View Hotel. Mm-hmm. It's right at the base of the Acropolis. And there was, it had a rooftop terrace and that nobody really seemed to know about. And we would go up there at night and have this amazing view of the Acropolis.
They light it up at night.
Yeah, yeah. And so we'd be sitting up there drinking wine and just, it was incredible. And I, you know, at the time when we were in Greece, there was also a lot of protests going on. A lot of strikes. And in fact, I think something got shut down while we were there. But I found the whole city to be very charming and very clean. And, you know, there were people like scrubbing down the railways going down into the subway. And, you know, the unemployment was really high, and anyone who had a job wanted a job, and, you know, they really wanted to keep it, and they would do whatever it seemed like. And one of my favorite things about Athens was there was a new museum where they were putting together a model of the Parthenon.
Oh, I didn't go there.
Or was it what's the building on top of the Acropolis?
It's the Parthenon. Yeah.
So they were building a life-size model of the Parthenon down there. And
oh, cool.
Yeah. And when you went into this museum, you were walking over an archaeological dig.
Oh, wow.
And you could look down and yeah, it's like my favorite museum in the world. It wasn't very big but it was just incredible.
That's one of the fun things about traveling to that region of the world is, you know, in the U.S., you go and you see a building that maybe was built in the, you know, oldest 1600s or something in New England.
Right.
And then you go to Greece or Turkey and it's like B.C.
You know? It's even like in Rome and Italy, you look and, you know, there's all this amazing artwork from the, you know, from the 1700s, 1600s, 1500s, but then in mm-hmm. Greece, it's thousands of years old.
Yes.
And it's so amazing.
Standing.
And the other thing is somehow we ended up kind of accidentally walking around the Acropolis at the base, and it's really, really far to get the whole way around. And it was really hot and dusty and thirsty. And I'm not quite sure why we were doing it.
Well, you were having an adventure, Monica.
You're traveling.
Yeah.
I had that happen in Paris, too. I was determined to make it to the Eiffel Tower. It's there on the horizon, you know. It's just a couple blocks away. And then you end up walking 3 miles.
Yes.
Oh, gosh.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Paris is definitely that way. I ended up walking through this horrible storm down the, you know, where the Orangerie is, that park. I can't remember the name of the park. And then it becomes that big avenue. It didn't seem like it was that far. I was with my niece and she was a little anxious about subways. And so we had gotten on the subway, but she couldn't tolerate it. So we got off and we started walking, and the storm came up, and it was, and we just kept walking and walking and walking and walking.
Trying to get somewhere.
Well, that is actually advice I give to people. I have had people that want to replicate our journey, and they ask, what are the most important things to bring? And I always say shoes. Shoes are, you know, that can make or break a journey. And my first few days in Istanbul, I actually had chosen the wrong pair of shoes. And we walked for miles. And so eventually we met a local woman, and she took me shoe shopping, and we got a much more practical pair that lasted the rest of the trip. But
now, why did you wear a dress?
You know, it wasn't what I was going to wear. I chose a dress because, well, I had started by saying, well, if we're going to go with nothing, and this was the week before we left, I ran to the store, and I'm thinking, I need to get quick dry, odor resistant, very practical, like travel gear. And everything I tried on, it just didn't feel right. I didn't want to wear it for 21 days. And so then I went to this Anthropology, and I saw this dress hanging on the rack, this green dress, and it was like the heavens opened up and the light shone down, and I knew I was going to wear that dress, and I figured, you know what, this is already such a ridiculous premise, that really, what can I do to make it any more ridiculous? It doesn't matter at this point, I might as well just wear a dress. And I knew I was at least going to be in Istanbul and London, which are these, you know, global cities, and I wanted to feel comfortable in them, you know, if we were to be in any nicer environment or, you know, just walking down the street, I didn't want to be wearing my travel gear. Mm. So I went with the dress.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Carolina. Our guest today is Clara Benson, author of No Baggage, A Minimalist Tale of Love and Wandering. So was that the Anthropology store across from Whole Foods?
Yes. Oh, my God.
I actually live part-time in Austin. And just a few blocks from there, I have a condo at Barton Place over on Barton Springs Road.
I know exactly where that is.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful, you know, I never lived in a city. I've always been in a small town. We're here in Fairfield, Iowa, which is about 10,000 people. And a few years ago, I decided to get a condo in Austin because I have grandkids in Round Rock. And my son and his family are up there. And, you know, I thought about getting a place up near them. And I thought, you know, I want to see what it's like to live in a city, in an urban environment, which I've never done. And I'm actually quite charmed by it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm not there, you know, I'm only there about 20% of the time.
Okay. And, well, it's a good city to be in 20% of the time, definitely.
Yeah.
That city plays a big role in the book and in my story with Jeff, too. So maybe we'll see you out there. We still go walking like we do when we travel. We just head out the door, and we walk around Austin and try to get lost in our own city. So maybe we'll run into you sometime.
It's a great – there's so many – of course, there's the whole trail system, you know, which I'm just a couple – like a block off of the Lady Bird Lake Trail, or Town Lake, I guess they call it now.
But, Town Lake. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and when any time that I've been down there, there's so many people, and it's really an interesting people watching environment.
Yes, there's no shortage of interesting characters in Austin.
And the last time I was down there, a friend and I walked clear over from where we were, you know, from Barton Place, clear over to the east side for the East Austin studio tour.
Oh, yeah. That's what I just went to that a few months ago.
Yeah.
I live on the east side.
Okay. And it was really, there's so many cool, funky places over there. And
so it's my favorite part of the city.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't it becoming very well known for all the music things?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, how long have you lived in Austin?
I have lived in Austin for 5 years, and I lived up in Fort Worth, which is 3 hours to the north, for 10 years, and then I actually grew up in Portland, Oregon, so I've been all over.
Now, Portland and Austin, there's kind of have a similar feel.
Except, they do. They're kind of sister cities.
Yeah, except that it's rains all the time in Portland, and and it's so dang hot in Austin.
Yes, it was definitely a culture shock moving from Portland to Fort Worth. The Oregon-Texas transition was tough. I actually write about that in the book I'm working on now, about growing up, and I was homeschooled my whole life, and I talk about what that was like. So that's the current work and project is
now how
explaining.
You do talk about that a little bit in this book too, and you know about sort of your relationship with your parents, and which seems to be pretty, you know, a good relationship. Did you have any problems, or are you running into them not wanting you to reveal too much as you're writing about this?
Yeah, that's something I constantly think about with this first one, and then definitely, I mean, writing about family,
yeah,
always going to be tricky. But what I've done is I've sat everyone down and said, you know, this is the story I'm telling. I'm open to hearing your perspectives, and it's a family story, so it involves all of us, although I'm the one that's writing it. But they've been pretty receptive. I think they trust me, and they've been so excited and supportive for this first book. They came to my reading the other day in Austin, and were thrilled. So we'll see what happens, but I'm hoping that it's a relatively smooth process.
And you write in here about, you know, part of the reason you were homeschooled was a religious reason. And you, at some point, sort of rebelled against that. Has that caused any issues, or did you sort of lead the way for the family rebellion?
I did some of it, you know, of course, but the interesting part of the story that I'm excited to write about is it was actually, you know, usually when one... These stories about leaving, you know, the church or whatever it is, the environment that you grew up in. It's usually one person, and then they're often ostracized from their family. But in my case, our whole family of seven kind of gravitated together through this crazy story that involves the Middle East, and it's definitely a journey, and so I think that's what's interesting about it. It wasn't just me that rebelled. It was, in a way, you know, my siblings and my mother and all of us together that did it.
That does sound like a great story. Now, you say you've done 5 no baggage trips. Have you written about any of the other ones?
I've written a little bit about the second one, which was to South America. And that trip I've written about because things went wrong. It was not as smooth of a trip as our first one or of any after that. So we learned a lot about what not to do on that trip. And one of the biggest things was just climate. You know, it's fine to wear one outfit for a uniform climate, whether it's hot or cold. But in South America, where we were, you know, we were dressed and prepared for the Andes Mountains, which we spent part of our time in. But then we were also down in the Atacama Desert, you know, and it's 110. And we've got these mountain boots on, and we're just totally miserable. So we learned from that. And we also had a really difficult border crossing from Ecuador to Peru. And it's a pretty tough border crossing, and we didn't get a passport stamp. And so when we tried to leave the country in Peru at the end of our trip, they escorted us out of the airport and mentioned that we might be drug runners or involved with some kind of criminal activity. And, you know, we had to stay several days and go through all the paperwork and standing in lines to get that figured out. So that was a much more challenging trip.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Were there times, like in this first trip, when you were just like, what am I doing?
Yeah. Yeah, Yes, especially at first, I was not sure how it was going to work out. Like with Jeff, you know, we could have discovered that we actually didn't care for each other during the intensity of travel pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, wearing the same outfit every day and washing my clothes in a sink. You know, we had a couple moments of just like, what are we doing? But then also, it kind of wore off as the trip progressed, too. By the end of it, the fact that we were traveling with no baggage actually became kind of it faded to the background. It wasn't that big of a deal. And it was more about exploring together in the moment. So, yes, at first, I was thinking this is crazy, but then as the trip progressed, it seemed more normal.
Why do you continue to travel that way?
Well, I mean, we kind of developed an enjoyment of it. I mean, like I said, Jeff really genuinely likes traveling with as lightly as possible. He doesn't like being encumbered in any way. And it's the same at home. Like, I think right now he has one outfit, and he wears it every day. I think there's a backup pair of pants, but he's just the same at home.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, this is his way of life, basically.
Wow. Boy, I have a closet full. Actually, I have two closets full, one up here and one in Austin.
Yeah, well, I have.
Oh, no. Yeah, well, I did. I came back from that first trip, and I also had a closet full, but after a really experiencing that lightness, it's a very physical thing, not having any belongings just on your shoulders. It made a huge impact on me. So I came home and I cleaned out half the stuff in my apartment, in my closet, gave it away, and I've really been happy about that decision. I haven't wanted any of it back.
You know, it is interesting how your stuff can end up owning you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true on the road, too. You know, you're constantly thinking about where it is, if it's safe, if someone on the train is going to try to take it, if you take a nap, and if you've got a nice camera. And you have to carry it, too. You have to, you know, lug it around. So not having that allowed me to focus on a lot of other things.
Wow. So tell us, we only have about 5 minutes left. Tell us a little bit about your writing process. Do you write all day, every day, certain amount of time? Are you trying to get a certain number of words done? Or how do you go about it?
Well, I mean, like I said, I was thrown into this process, so I had to kind of invent my process on the fly. And I'm not one of those people that can just sit and write for 8 hours at a time. I don't know if those people exist. I hear they do, like in legends, but I can only do 4 or 5 max hours of writing a day, and then I have to either read or research or do something else. My focus only extends that long. And I've also discovered I'm not a rapid writer either. I think about things. I like to process where I'm going with each chapter, and I've kind of come to terms with the fact that I'm pretty slow. So, yeah, I've got a little coffee shop route in Austin, and I visit one each day. There's a lot of coffee shops here, so...
Well, tell me some of your favorites, because I've been trying to hit the highlights of the coffee shops.
Well, on the east side, which is mostly where I am, there's Figure Eight, and there's Brew and Brew. There's a Japanese-style one called Saten that's great. We've got Thunderbird up a little bit north, and Cafe Medici is always...
Yeah, there's several of those.
Go to a different coffee shop every day of the month here.
Oh, I know. I like Cafe Medici. I like Dominican Joe's.
Yeah, they're good.
Yeah, huh? And Monkey's Nest.
Yeah, Monkey Nest is fun, too.
That's a funny, that is a very funny name, Monkey's Nest.
Yeah. So, when you started writing No Baggage, did you, how did you think about the structure of the book?
It took me a long time. I had to write a proposal to sell, and it took me several months to play with different ideas. My book has a kind of a flashback structure to memories of before I met Jeff and before we took the trip, so I had to play around with how that worked in terms of the time. And and the proposal I sold, I ended up changing the structure afterwards too. So, you know, there was a lot of moving pieces, and it took me a while to settle on the structure that I wanted. And, you know, that's just how writing has been for me. It's trial and error. There was a lot of pressure because I had the book deal, and we sold it in all these countries too. So I'm thinking, like, I gotta figure this out.
Wow.
And I did, you know. I think for a first book, it was, and the time that I had, it was my best shot, definitely.
And do you have a film deal with it also?
Oh, yes, I do. That was also interesting. We sold the film rights right when I sold when I got the book deal. And so what happened was the screenwriter was actually writing the screenplay as I was writing. I mean, he had a summary and, you know, he had all the basic, he knew where I was going, but we were kind of writing together. I would finish a chapter, send it to him, and then he would add it to whatever he was working on. And it's a really fun adaptation of the book.
Wow. And so is that actually being made?
Well, Hollywood works a little bit different. Their timelines, no one ever knows, but it's pretty far down the production process. You know, there's, in addition to just being optioned, the screenplay is finished, and they're looking at casting. But it is Hollywood, so, you know, we will see. It would be really fun if it did get made.
And who do you want to play you?
Huh?
Who do you want to play you?
Oh, I can't. I get this question sometimes, and I don't know what to say. It's just such a bizarre thing to think about. Someone playing me. I don't know. I don't know.
Wow.
Whoever it is, I am sure it will be a lot of fun.
I can't wait to see it. I think that would be, it would definitely be a lot of fun. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Clara.
Thank you for having me.
It's just such a delightful story, you know, how everything fell together in terms of becoming a writer for you. We've talked to a lot of writers, and everybody's story of how they got published and how they became a writer is a little different.
Yeah,
you know, you just...
Which is interesting in itself, that there's so many different approaches.
It's true. It's true. But I think one thing that's important is that lesson to learn is that you did the work. You had to actually sit down and write the book.
There's no getting around it.
Yeah,
that's right.
Well, let us know when your next book comes out.
I will do that.
All right.
I look forward to it.
You know, my outtake fits perfectly.
It does.
It's true. If it's going to be, it's up to me. At the same time, realize no one ever achieves anything alone.
Ah. And who said that? Do you know?
I don't know. This is a book, Things Everyone Should Know.
And stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild if you're listening to us on Friday. And if you're listening to us on Monday morning, have a great week. And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.